just to be able to investigate whether this was the act of one madman or a generally accepted settler policy, we went to Kiryat Arba to interview people. And in the settlement, there is a grave for Baruch Goldstein. Until about a week before we arrived, there was a very substantial monument honoring him with flowers and photographs. And it was a favorite spot of journalists to go to take pictures because it indicated how the settlers viewed Baruch Goldstein as a hero rather than as a maniac and a murderer. When we arrived, that was taken down because the government had ordered it to be downgraded. But near his grave, this man was under a tree and agreed to be interviewed by us on video. And we talked to him for a little while, very soft-spoken man with impeccable English. He's originally from Arizona. We asked him why he was living in Kiryat Arba, and he said he believed that God gave the land to his people, and it was his traditional ancestral home. And we asked if his family had left, you know, that land to come to Arizona. And it was beyond his family memory, but, you know, for him it was a very strong conviction. We asked him what he thought of Baruch Goldstein, and he described him as a great hero. We asked him what he thought of Ariel Sharon, and he said he thought he was too moderate and that he had abandoned the settlers. And we said what he thought was needed for there to be peace in the region. He said there needs to be a bloody war. And he says after the bloody war there will be peace. We asked him what about the scriptural promise of the lion laying down with the lamb, beating swords into plowshares, so on. He said that'll come true as well. He said, but after the bloody war when the Arabs are dead. And the thing was that all the while, very soft-spoken, very gentle voice, giving us this really very scary and racist and militarist image. For many Palestinians, by the late 1990s, they had concluded that they weren't on the road to peace. They were on the road to ethnic cleansing and to cultural elimination and humiliation. And this graffiti in the Dehesha refugee camp of them being strip searched is just one more example of their day-to-day. The man being strip searched can be a teenager, can be a PhD, can be a grandfather. Anyone can be stopped by an 18-year-old Israeli soldier and forced to disrobe, and just a sense of humiliation and defeat. It was in that context of despair that Ariel Sharon, a former defense minister, Israeli defense minister, marched 500 troops to the Dome of the Rock 21 months ago. And the Dome of the Rock is the second holiest spot in the world for Muslims, and it's also the place of the site of the last Jewish temple. And just to the side is the site of the Wailing Wall, a sacred spot for Judaism. So it's a contentious place, and there is an extremist group inside Israel that every year marches to the Dome of the Rock with the intention of laying a cornerstone for a new temple, which de facto would mean the destruction of the Al-Aqsa Mosque you're seeing here. So it's really a contentious spot. And by marching 500 soldiers there, it was a very provocative act, and it led immediately to rioting. And images came in the States of Palestinians throwing stones down on worshippers at the Wailing Wall. People were killed, and the Second Intifada began. And it began as with lots of demonstrations, boycotts, strikes, and acts of violence by both sides. Ariel Sharon, you would think, might have been prosecuted for this provocation, reprimanded. It could have possibly have reinstalled confidence in the Palestinian community, but he was not. In fact, he was elected prime minister in the aftermath. And upon taking control of Israel, he promised the Israeli people that he would put an end to terrorism and make the Israeli people more safe, their society more safe. And one of the ways in which he chose to do this was by beginning a policy no longer of demanding the Palestinian Authority to turn over suspects to be arrested, but just identifying those people and then sending commando units into the Palestinian-controlled areas to assassinate them. Sometimes these units would go in this case, shoot out the tires of a car and then fire on the driver. In other instances, they used helicopters to fire missiles. A number of civilians were killed as well as the suspected people, but in all cases, no trial was held, no charges brought, no evidence brought. And the United States repeatedly objected to this policy of targeted assassination. Also, with the increase in violence by the Israelis, there was an increase in violence by the Palestinians. For the first time, it was common to see a Palestinian militia groups carrying guns. In 88, it was unheard of. Stones, occasionally a Molotov cocktail. Now there would be rifles, as in Bethlehem here, where you'd see these groups of Tanzim, irregular Palestinian militia, firing at Israeli soldiers at the Tomb of Rachel, a fortified position just down the street. So, the violence, again, still is ratcheting up on both sides proportionately. Now, for every instance that Palestinians would fire guns, sometimes they would fire from the heights of Beit Jala to Gilo, that settlement that showed the access road. And if they did that, the Israelis would return tank fire and artillery fire on the Palestinian-controlled areas. And if you're in Bethlehem, Beit Jala, Hebron, Ramallah, you can go to the outskirts and just follow around the edges, and you will see a line of artillery emplacements every 400 meters all the way around, encircling each of these Palestinian areas. And if you look back inwards, you'll see the entrances to all the Palestinian towns and cities look like this. All of them look like Beirut. Because every time that there would be a firing coming out, they would fire in with artillery. And none of these attacks would reach the west. So this kind of thing would happen and not really be reported. In the context of this use of artillery, use of targeted assassinations, growing number of casualties. Last spring, the casualty rate was 4-1 Palestinians to Israelis. The Palestinian representative to the UN made a resolution for the introduction of UN peacekeeping forces and UN monitors. This resolution would have passed, but the United States vetoed it. For many in the moderate Palestinian community, the veto by the United States last spring was the final straw, was a sense that now we are ultimately alone. We will die and no one will even witness it. No one will even come and try to stop it. And it was after that veto that there was increase in suicide bombings. There were only 2 suicide bombings prior to that veto in the previous 10 years. There have been more than 30 since, including one yesterday. And this is the site of one of those suicide bombings. It's a Sparrow Pizza restaurant in West Jerusalem where 16 Israelis were killed, including a number of children and even an infant. And this is the day after it happened, and it's already been boarded up. These acts, I want to really make it clear, they're different from stone throwing. They're different from the political strikes and other types of resistance, because they're not essentially for the end of the, they are for the end of the occupation, but they're not essentially politically driven. They're essentially acts by people. In all instances, suicide bombers have had immediate family members die. They're by people who are despaired of there being a solution, who are doing acts strictly vengeful and violent, almost like saying, while our people are going to die, at least some of yours will die as well. I mean, they're extraordinarily despairing and hateful acts. And they've been directed at places that are really shocking to us, like a pizza restaurant, a wedding party, a Passover party, a disco in Tel Aviv, buses. There was a bus yesterday that was attacked. These are ordinary places to us, and it's really very shocking. But from the Palestinian end, these are places of ordinary daily life that they don't enjoy under occupation. When they're under curfew and under restrictions and 80% unemployment because of these things, their lives are so difficult that they feel enormous rage toward the Palestinians, towards the Israelis in the nightclubs and discos and pizza restaurants and at parties and weddings going on with normal life while they are existing under such occupation. I don't justify this at all, but that's some of the motivation that drives them. And these are extraordinarily hateful and violent acts, and I'm categorically opposed to them. At the same time, each time there would be a suicide bombing, many of these suicide bombings, the vast majority, were claimed by Islamic Jihad, Hamas, and other groups like that, which do not support the Palestinian Authority's acceptance of the State of Israel. They call for the elimination of the State of Israel. Nonetheless, after these would happen, the Israelis would have retaliatory military strikes from the air, from jets, not against Hamas or Islamic Jihad, but against the Palestinian Authority. And they would bomb police stations, courthouses, jails, and municipal buildings in the Palestinian cities. This is in Jenin City, and this one is in Bethlehem. Very, very, very substantial destruction. And the irony of this is the Palestinian Authority is a moderate Palestinian group which acknowledges the existence of Israel. So by attacking them and then making statements, the Palestinian Authority isn't doing enough to stop terrorism, by blowing up police stations and jails and so on, and courthouses, you make it that much harder for Palestinian Authority to enforce any kind of security. So it was really kind of a counterproductive and suspicious policy, which made many Palestinians think that Ariel Sharon was not really trying to respond to terrorism, but was using this as a pretext to destroy the building of a Palestinian state, and that he had really opposed even the little bit of autonomy given by Oslo and was using that as an excuse to destroy it. Now, we all hear about terrorism, and one of the things we heard about with the Palestinians was, some of you may have seen the CNN clip, that after September 11th purported to show Palestinians dancing with joy over what happened in New York City and Washington, D.C. I never saw that particular clip, but I was in the region on October 4th, not many weeks later. And this is an AP photo from September 12th, when 10,000 Palestinians marched to the U.S. consulate to denounce terrorism. This is another Associated Press photo of Palestinian children, some of 2 million who demonstrated on the 13th, who held a candlelight vigil for the victims of terrorism in New York and Washington, D.C. On the 14th, over 200 Palestinian Authority representatives, including Yasser Arafat, donated blood for the victims of terrorism in New York City. So this was, and people I spoke to in October, cabbies, ordinary people in all the different regions, I said, what did you think of what happened on September 11th? They would consistently say, we opposed it. What a horrible thing. They said they cried when they heard about it. But nonetheless, there persists a sort of a lump one all Arabs, all Muslims in a kind of a terrorist grab bag. Whether it has any basis in reality or not is another story. But anyway, that's one of the side notes. And it's also important to realize, in spite of this occupation, in spite of all the violence, in spite of the retaliation from both sides, there are nonviolent voices that are still there. And this is really the heart of what I want to try to convey to you people tonight, is that there are alternative voices. This is Atta Jaber. He's a Palestinian farmer. He and his family have farmed land outside the Kiryat Arba settlement for centuries. They grow grapes, tomatoes, and olives. And last year, settlers seized 200 acres of his land where there were 500 olive trees, and they bulldozed and uprooted them. This is a horrible event for Palestinians, because these trees can live up to 2,000 years. Even Greenpeace objected to this particular attack. And even though they bulldozed them last year, the area where they bulldozed and seized is still just a desert area. They didn't even build anything there. But he's the person whose car was burned the night before. And in spite of those attacks and that kind of hatred, he just built a new house for his young wife and their two small children on his property. And the cornerstone of that house has a dedication in Hebrew and Arabic with a Star of David and a moon and star, welcoming all lovers of peace to his home. And he continues to insist that he does not hate Jews, and he still welcomes peace activists to his home, Israeli peace activists as well as Palestinians. The man on the right is Ghassan Andani, the founder and the executive director of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement in Bethlehem and Beit Zahur, a wonderful nonviolent group with Gandhian roots. And he works very, very, very tirelessly for an end to the occupation through nonviolent means. He also works very closely and collaboratively with Israeli peace activists. He's a wonderful activist. This is, I'm always getting the poor man's name wrong, Raja Shahada. And he is the founder of Al-Haq, a group of Palestinian lawyers and who study human rights violations. A wonderful activist. He's in Ramallah. This is during a curfew in Ramallah where you could be shot at any time. And nonetheless, he's in his yard planting a tree. And I asked him what he was doing. He says, you have to have hope for the future. His father, by the way, was a Palestinian lawyer, was the first Palestinian to suggest the creation of two states, Israeli and Palestinian states, side by side. He made that suggestion in July of 1967. So there were Palestinian moderates even so long ago as 67. Also, when the Israeli army was striking very, very hard against Beit Jala, blowing up homes with tanks, this woman on the right, an Israeli Jew, Netta Golan, went to Beit Jala, went into one of the homes that was at risk on the heights, and draped an Israeli flag out the window, and effectively said to the Israeli soldiers, there's an Israeli Jew here, and if you fire, you'll kill me too. And she did this repeatedly where there were Israeli attacks, and gained a great deal at that time last spring of international media attention for her bravery and also for the effectiveness that her actions had in stopping Israeli attacks. And in the midst of that media, she began to appeal for other internationals to come since the U.S. had vetoed an official force coming, say, why don't people come on their own unofficially? And that really, her actions really began the international solidarity movement. Sorry for the focus on these slides. Could be my eyes. I am getting older. But and these are some of the people that have come, Italian and British peace activists who started coming last spring. And these activists would, some of them were ordinary people. Others were kind of prominent people like Mairead Maguire, the 1976 Nobel laureate from Ireland, or this woman on the left, Luisa Morgantini, a member of the Italian Parliament. And in many instances, the internationals would form human shields to protect Palestinians who would want to do demonstrations or even carry out ordinary acts like travel to the hospital or go to places for permits or remove barricades. And so the internationals could help save lives and promote nonviolence through being present. And the Israeli peace movement also began to really grow in the after the onset of Ariel Sharon's rise to power. One group, wonderful Israeli group that's been around actually for 20 years, is the Women in Black, a great Israeli feminist group that vigils every week in Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem. And very, very strong, very brave women. They've been spat on, they've had their signs torn, they've had their banners set on fire, but they are very feisty, very brave, and very good-humored too. A lot of them are elderly women, a wonderful, wonderful group. Then there's also Rabbis for Human Rights, another great group. This is their executive director, Rabbi Arik Asherman. And they're a group of religious Israelis who work not only against the occupation through demonstrations and publication, but also they go into the West Bank and Gaza Strip to help protect Palestinians. In this instance, they're going to a village of Bedouins south of Hebron, where Jewish settlers had come and taken a cat and tied felt to its tail and dipped it in gasoline and set the tail on fire and let that cat go in these wheat fields that these Palestinian Bedouins had to set the fields on fire. And when the Palestinians tried to put the fires out, they fired guns on them from the heights. So the Palestinians were afraid to harvest their crops, remaining crops. But Rabbis for Human Rights sent observant Jews who helped them do this work. And so this is a really courageous and collaborative effort of Israeli Jews working with Palestinians. This is Chad Lechner, an American Israeli dual citizenship, American Jew, and he heads a group called Olive Tree Summer, which each summer goes and they replant olive trees uprooted by soldiers or settlers. And sometimes they're immediately uprooted again, but nonetheless they make this effort. And he's showing his back here because he was in a demonstration in East Jerusalem when Israeli riot police hit him with iron rods. I think they cracked two of his ribs, and you can see the bruises there. So this is a new generation of Israelis and Israeli Americans who are not only willing to say the occupation is wrong, but they're willing to risk themselves and risk some physical harm to themselves to see that that change come. And some of the people, Huwaida Arif, an American Palestinian on the left, and Adam Shapiro, an American Jew from Brooklyn on the right, in the International Solidarity Movement, big leaders in that movement, have really taken nonviolence to another level. Really not only risking their lives, but putting themselves literally almost like Tiananmen Square in front of tanks, in front of soldiers, and saying, these people, Jews, Muslims, whatever, will not die, without somebody in the middle, trying to stop it. These two, by the way, not only became very active and very involved, they actually were married last week. So sometimes when you're a peace activist, you get a little spin-off in your personal life. That's how I met my wife, actually. But anyway, now to the most recent events. On March 31st, Good Friday in the Western Catholic calendar, the Israelis invaded the most of the West Bank. And ostensibly in response to a terrorist act that had happened the day before, but Jane's Military Magazine in Britain confirmed that Ariel Sharon had the full plans established weeks before and that the tanks actually were already in place. And so that was really merely a pretext. The incursion was ostensibly to downgrade the Palestinian ability to launch suicide bombing in the West Bank, an anti-terrorist attack. But as you'll see, it was far more than that. And this is the first place attack. One of the first places is Bethlehem. And they did very substantial destruction. Over 300 tanks and armored personnel carriers attacked in Bethlehem. And these slides were taken when they were still in occupation and a curfew was in force in the city. And you can see up above in that building there between the two windows, there's a hole from a tank shell. Many civilian homes were attacked with tanks. And in the streets, they were burnt out and destroyed cars, bullet holes in the cars. There's 80% unemployment right now in the West Bank and Gaza Strip because of the closures. So none of this destruction can be repaired by Palestinians. The old city is just filled with destruction, debris, no running water. The electricity was intermittent, fires, garbage. Again, another house where there was a tank shell. This is the owner wanted to make a point of showing remains of the shell and show the markings that the shell was from the United States. Oftentimes, in the high buildings, it would be Israeli snipers. By the time we were there, it was 10 days into the attack. There were no more fighting from Palestinians, although there were people held up in the Church of the Nativity. So the only shooting from the buildings would be Israeli snipers. And you could always tell because it's high-caliber bullets, which make a very, very a much louder sound than the Palestinian lower-caliber 22s and so on. In the streets, you would run into Israeli patrols sometimes. Sometimes they'd fire at you. In this instance, they just took us international activists and forced us back to the Star Hotel, which was the only hotel that had activists, and all the media from all over the world was in this one hotel. CNN, New York Times, the BBC, everybody's all jammed in this one hotel. And when the media would go out, they'd go out heavy body armor, collars, helmets, and nonetheless, Anthony Shadid from the Boston Globe was shot in Ramallah. And he did a wonderful piece in the Globe 2 weeks ago talking about it. He and 16 other journalists were shot by the Israelis. And a committee of journalists actually issued a protest saying that they believed it was a deliberate campaign by the Israelis to frustrate reporting of the occupation. So when these people would go out dressed like this, nonetheless, they'd be terrified they're going to be shot. So they would always ask members of the International Solidarity Movement and other international activist groups to walk in front of them. So here we are, in our T-shirts and, you know, no body armor, whatever, and we're walking in front of the journalists and, you know, hunkered under this, you know, thick 3 inches of flak jackets. It felt a little strange. And there were activists when I was there in April, there were activists from 25 countries who had come. As diverse as Iceland, Denmark in this instance, Austria, Japan, Brazil, Chile. Just an incredible array of internationals who would come at their own expense to try to be eyewitnesses and a force for peace. In this instance, a number of us from our particular Catholic worker group wanted to go to the Dehesha refugee camp outside of Bethlehem, and the only way to go was to walk through the curfewed streets, so we carried a Red Cross Red Crescent banner to try to protect us. We were still sniped at twice by Israeli soldiers, once from behind and once from the forward, so it's a little unclear where they wanted us to go. And we were also stopped by an armored personnel carrier with a machine gun mounted at the top and by a tank, which swiveled its barrel on us. Talk about an overkill. You got 11 motley activists and a tank about 10 feet away pointing its barrel at us. So this tank and armored personnel carrier finally left us alone when a Palestinian ambulance raced by with its lights flashing to take someone to the hospital. And they stopped the ambulance, took the patients out, took the drivers out, strip searched them. This is a big human rights abuse of them stopping ambulances, and many, many, many people have died over the last year because they can't reach hospitals because of these stoppings. And many ambulances we saw actually had bullet holes in them from Israeli soldiers that had fired at them. One soldier told us in Ramallah, I said, why do you fire at these ambulances? And he said, the ambulances are used by Palestinians to transport explosives. And I said, really? I said, have you ever found any explosives in any vehicles you stopped? And he said, well, I heard it happened elsewhere. And so this is one of those kind of rumors that, you know, that justifies a human rights abuse. When we returned back to the Star Hotel, a UN truck had arrived and was looking for a place to drop quite a bit of relief supplies because, see, the whole town was curfewed. Nobody could get food or water or whatever. And we helped them unload this 18-wheeler truck into a basement. And this UN worker from Germany wanted a photo pose because I had said afterwards, that's good German organization because we've made a big misaligned. But the next morning, we realized there was no mechanism for distributing this food. So a number of international activists from Austria, Sweden, Belgium, Denmark, the United States, we filled canvas bags with rice, oil, about as much as we could carry. And that's the Star Hotel on the rise there. And we walked through the curfewed streets into areas near the Church of the Nativity to give out food. Now, there are There's gunfire periodically. There are tanks racing through the street and armored vehicles and foot patrols. We eluded them three times delivering food, and then we were finally stopped by an Israeli patrol which refused to allow us to deliver any more food, and we had to retreat. This is the view from towards the Church of the Nativity from the roof of the there's actually a restaurant on the top floor of the Church of the Star Hotel. I was taking this shot from the window when an AP journalist came over and pulled me away and pointed to a bullet hole in the window above and said that a photographer had been taking a picture the day before when an Israeli sniper fired at him and he got glass in his eye. So the only people in this hotel, again, are international activists and journalists. So firing here underscores the suspicion of Anthony Shadid and others that the Israelis are firing at journalists. This hotel was actually commandeered by the Israelis the day afterwards, and they took over the top floor for a sniper post. So this is the last photo taken from there. We went the next day to Ramallah, and to get to Ramallah, you had to take from Jerusalem a Palestinian van taxi to the outskirts of the city. There was a checkpoint there going into Ramallah, and I think it was 3 days before, 10,000 Israeli activists had come with three truckloads of relief supplies to deliver into Ramallah and had gotten to this checkpoint, and the soldiers refused to allow them to go through because the area was under curfew. The demonstrators sat down. The soldiers tear gassed them, used percussion bombs, and even beat some people. But the Israelis stood firm. And after 4 hours of demonstration and negotiation, they finally allowed these relief trucks with 20 or 30 activists to go through to deliver them to Ramallah. So this was quite a peace action, but also it was a confirmation that we were unlikely to get into Ramallah through that checkpoint. So what we did is we went to the outskirts of Ramallah, we got out of our taxis, and we went over the desert, across land, to another clandestine taxi area that took us into the outskirts, and then we would wait, and Palestinian ambulances would come and take six of us at a time into the hospital in the center of the city. And these ambulances were bullet-ridden, and you'd run through the curfewed streets racing. And one of the ambulances, the one I rode in, made it to the hospital without incident. The other, which other activists from the United States were in and other countries, was stopped by Israeli soldiers. They were made to come out, partially strip-searched, and only after repeatedly showing the U.S. passports and stressing we weren't journalists did they allow them to continue. When we arrived at the hospital, we ran into Adam Shapiro on the right, the American-Israeli activist, American-Jewish activist from Brooklyn, and the woman on the left, Chevis Moore, she's an American originally from Missouri, and what she was doing as an international there is riding in ambulances as an escort, Palestinian drivers, using the Red Cross, Red Crescent relief team jacket. So the presence of an international would frustrate the Israelis from shooting a driver or taking prisoner a wounded person in the back of the ambulance. That's a Japanese journalist in the back, by the way. In the hospital, this nurse practitioner toured us. There were four gunshot wound victims. And the city was still under a very strict curfew, and there was sporadic gunfire outside, all heavy caliber, all Israeli, and sporadic explosions from tank firings around the city. These four people all had gunshot wounds, three of them abdominal, and one, this man was shot through the throat, through the tongue, through the teeth, and through the nose, single bullet. And two of these gunshot wound victims were Palestinian police officers, ostensibly armed. Two others were bystanders. All of them had been denied medical care for hours, and one of them had three others with him that were put on the ground. The three others bled to death before the Red Cross, Red Crescent could negotiate the delivery of him to the hospital. And then after these four were brought to the hospital, 2 days previous to this photo, an Israeli patrol attacked the hospital to take them all prisoner. But luckily, 100 Italian peace activists were there, led by an Italian Catholic priest who insisted on laying down on the ground in front of the Israeli soldiers in the lobby of the hospital, and the Israelis gave it up. Because of that action, we were all, our group of 11, was asked to stay up all night in three-hour shifts at the hospital in case another Israeli patrol came to take people away. But this didn't happen. The worst thing that happened to us at night was playing cards with the Palestinians, and I will tell you with all honesty and integrity that Palestinians, when they play cards, they cheat. It was shameless. It was shameless. And one of the women in our group, she would always say, "Do you want to play?" Because they would stand behind her and say, and they'd pick the cards for her to put down. "No, you do this, you do that." And they'd say, "Do you really want to play?" "No, you're doing fine." you know, and they would do everything for her. You know, blatant sexist too. But anyway, that was a rather uneventful night. The next day, we went into the parking lot of the hospital where 3 days before they had dug up the parking lot to build a mass grave. Between 29 and 32, there was some question of number of people that were buried here. And a number of gunshot wound victims had made it to the hospital, the bodies or the people themselves, and the morgue only has a capacity of 19. So with the warm weather, they had to be buried unceremoniously in the parking lot. 10 of these were women, and I believe 6 were children. So this was one of the things we saw. And then we wanted to see more of Ramallah itself,